This is our first storm of the season where we produce tropical storm type winds.
A massive windstorm hit south central Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, biologists puzzle over the struggling Cook Inlet beluga population.
It does concern me that we could see the extinction of this population in my lifetime.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
An unusually strong windstorm is affecting a huge swath of south-central Alaska. The storm stretches from Adak in the south and west to Big Delta in the eastern interior. Dave Snyder is a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Anchorage.
Well, this is a massive storm. The storms that we look at on the map here would cover tens of states, if not greater than that, considering Alaska's what, three times larger than Texas or something like that. I mean, this is a big storm on the map.
In Anchorage, the National Weather Service is predicting the high winds to peak around midnight with gusts of up to 100 miles per hour on the hillside and 60 miles per hour in East Anchorage. Snyder calls it a potent system and says it's comparable to a tropical storm.
Alaska doesn't get hurricanes, it doesn't get tropical weather, but it does get very strong wind storms that thrive on the energy rotating around the Arctic and in the northern latitudes. And this is our first storm of the season where we produce, tropical storm type winds. It's not tropical in nature, but at the end of the day, the effects can be pretty similar in some places.
Snyder says the strongest winds are predicted to move through the region relatively quickly, but he says the Anchorage area could still see wind gusts between 30 and 40 miles per hour into Wednesday evening and Thursday morning. The high wind warning is in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow morning. Power companies in Anchorage are bracing for outages, and emergency management officials are asking residents to be prepared. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
With winds predicted to reach upwards of 80 miles per hour in parts of Anchorage tonight, the power companies are preparing for a busy night. Sarah Wickers is the communications coordinator for Chugach Electric. She says power outages are expected and Chugach has crews on hand to handle downed trees and lines.
There's not a whole lot we can do in preparation of a storm. We always like to tell our customers, if you see a down power line, don't go near it, don't touch it, don't do any of that, just call us immediately.
Anchorage Municipal Light and Power representatives say they also have crews in place to respond to down lines. The strongest winds are expected to develop along Turnagain Arm and the higher elevations of the Anchorage Hillside, the Eagle River Valley, and parts of East Anchorage tonight. With the ground still unfrozen and leaves still on the trees, officials worry the storm could take down trees. Jeremy Zittick is with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says his office is not issuing an official advisory, but they are asking residents to secure outdoor equipment and pick up loose debris before the storm hits. Zittick also says it's a great opportunity to put an emergency kit and plan together.
The kit has basic supplies like food, water, a flashlight, a first aid kit. The plan is a communication plan so families can communicate if an event happens. Everyone knows who to call, where to go.
High-profile vehicles traveling along Turnagain Arm are also being asked to use extreme caution. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Anchorage will pay more than $5.5 million to settle 11 civil lawsuits filed by women who claimed they were raped by a police officer. Mayor Dan Sullivan's office announced the settlement today in a news release. The women claimed in their lawsuits that the city failed to supervise and discipline Officer Anthony Rollins. Rollins was convicted last year of sexually assaulting five women while on duty. He was sentenced to serve 87 years. Those five women and others who claimed they were also victims sued the city City and Rawlins separately. Rawlins was not part of the city's settlement, and several of the women have indicated they will continue with their lawsuits against him. The settlements range in size from $1.7 million for one victim down to $75,000. The annual summer effort to determine the number of endangered whales that exist in Cook Inlet is wrapping up, with one count completed in June and another finished in August. Christy Sims, a biologist with NOAA, has been involved with the annual whale census for more than a decade. The flagging numbers of the belugas make the count important. As Sims heads across the tarmac for an afternoon aerial survey of Cook Inlet, she says the August count is focused on calves, and after several days of capturing video, the real work starts.
It can take anywhere from 3 to 5 months to count it, depending on how many groups we encounter, how many passes of video we were able to collect on those groups based on weather conditions, glare, sun, and then some of the video passes have to be dropped due to white caps or glare.
The quarters in the twin engine plane are tight for three scientists and their camera gear.
Close the box and we sit on it. Like this. We have this monopod leg brace. We move this one forward and then we open this window here.
The bubble-shaped windows on the aircraft aid in the visual count that is compared later to video. The effort to meticulously count the whales is part of the work of documenting their overall status. Marine biologists and others who have studied the endangered whales are stymied by the declining numbers. Why haven't the belugas bounced back?
That's the $64,000 question. We really don't know.
Dr. Leslie Cornick is an associate professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University. She has researched both Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet belugas. Dr. Cornick studies how the animals sustain themselves in the ocean. She says the prey range of Cook Inlet belugas has contracted to the north.
Unfortunately for Cook Inlet beluga whales, really the primary thing that drives where animals choose to be is where their prey is. And for Cook Inlet beluga whales in the summer and fall, their prey is in the upper reaches of Kinnick Arm and Turnagain Arm, where those really yummy, delicious salmon and ulacan runs are.
This is also where there is more human and industrial activity. The Cook Inlet beluga numbers have hovered around 300 for several years. Lloyd Lowry worked as a marine biologist for the state of Alaska for 25 years. He wonders why a nearby population of Bristol Bay belugas is doing well while the Cook Inlet belugas continue to suffer.
It just doesn't make sense that this many years later there hasn't been a bounce back in the number of beluga whales. It just doesn't really seem to make sense.
He says the Bristol Bay population is thriving at around 2,000 whales and growing at a 5% rate per year. He says obvious impacts like ship strikes don't explain what is happening to Cook Inlet whales.
So that leaves you to conclude that there are some cryptic things going on that have to do with the quality of the habitat, the availability of food, the impact of predators or disease, potentially impact of contaminants, disturbance. Those kinds of things that are operating at much more subtle levels are an important part of the picture. It's not just the obvious mortality that you can quantify.
Because there has been no subsistence harvest of Cook Inlet belugas since 2005, and the harvest was tightly regulated in 1999, biologists expected the population to increase. But that hasn't happened. Now, potential suspects in Cook Inlet range from low availability of food to industrialization, contaminants from city street runoff, airport de-icer, and Anchorage's exemption for secondary treatment of sewage. Lowry says so far there hasn't been high concentrations of contaminants, but tests can't be taken now. Leslie Cornick agrees that past tests have found the Cook Inlet belugas quite clean of contaminants, but she says changing ocean conditions are key.
I really like the term global weirding, as opposed to global warming. It's not really about everything getting warmer. It's just about everything becoming more chaotic and unpredictable. You know, what does climate change have to do with Cook Inlet beluga whales? It could have a lot to do with Cook Inlet beluga whales because it has a lot to do with the health of the ocean. And it's the health of the ocean overall that is really the culprit.
She says top predators throughout the North Pacific and the Gulf of Alaska are in trouble, and they are the canary in the coal mine. Cornick says using the oceans for dumping pits, as humans have for thousands of years, is taking its toll. And for Cook Inlet belugas, there isn't much time.
That's actually the thing that worries me, because when you're dealing with a population that's, you know, only about 300 or so animals, you don't really have decades. And, you know, it does concern me that we could see the extinction of this population in my lifetime.
Tomorrow, we'll look at efforts aimed at helping the belugas recover and the problems that stem from that work. A federal office in Washington issued a report today guiding would-be natural gas producers on the North Slope on how to navigate federal regulations. APRN's Peter Granitz reports from Washington, D.C.
Larry Persily is the federal coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline and authored the report. He called it a tool for any company that, in the future, chooses to pursue a pipeline, regardless of its destination.
Whether you build a pipeline from the North Slope to the Canadian border to serve North American markets, or you build a pipeline from the North Slope to Tidewater in Valdez or Kenai somewhere to serve Asian markets, all of these environmental permitting issues are going to be the same.
The report examines a whole host of permitting issues, from clean water and air regulations to possible dredging sites for dock expansion. And it recommends potential pipeline applicants survey the native communities once they select a route, because the company will need to abide by government-to-government requirements.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission wants to know who lives out there, how much they depend on what resources, be it fish, fowl, caribou, whatever, and where's the hunting grounds, what seasons. Those are things you've got to know so that you can build a project without hurting someone else along the way.
Of course, the real barrier to a pipeline is not environmental regulation. It's the global market for natural gas. Persily says there won't be any pipeline until companies see the $40 billion one would cost as a sound investment. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new take on reviving a dying native language.
We tried to teach our native languages the same way that English is taught, but it didn't work.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports, faa.gov/go/flyalaska, or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly has voted to sell the ice-class ferry Susitna. In a brief meeting last week, they approved the sale. The ferry has been a problem for the borough because the unique ship has no place to dock on either side of Kinnick Arm. Matsu Borough Manager John Moosey says the assembly made the decision at a special meeting on August 28th.
At that special assembly meeting, they gave myself authority to list a boat with a broker for a potential sale, also to put the boat on the federal surplus register for potential use in another federal government agency.
Moosey says the vessel can't just be listed for sale anywhere.
We are assuming this is going to be a multi-million dollar purchase. And number two, because of the proprietary nature on the boat design and some of the items on the boat, we don't feel comfortable selling it to anyone. This was a joint project between the Navy and ourselves and Federal Transportation Authority. So we need to make sure that their concerns are also met with any type of transfer of this vessel.
The Susitna has been in the news in recent weeks since the Borough Assembly is struggling to find a solution for storing the vessel. The cost of insuring the vessel for 1 year is $600,000. Moosey says there is no firm asking price yet for the Susitna. The Bethel Airport is the third busiest passenger airport and the second busiest cargo airport in the state. But air traffic has been more complicated this summer because of ongoing construction at the airport. High winds, which are common in the region, are all it takes for a flight delay or cancellation. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The project to resurface the runway has cut the size in half, which has prevented many larger planes from landing. instrument approaches have been closed by the FAA. Some say over 100 Alaska Airlines flights alone have been affected this summer.
I think that the State Department of Transportation has to realize what a serious issue this is for this community.
That is Bethel City Council Member Rick Robb at a meeting August 28th. He said the delayed project is beyond an inconvenience. He says it's affecting the economic lifeblood of the community and it's a safety concern.
We have people right now in our hospital that are trying to go to hospitals in Anchorage that can't get out. I happen to work for YKHC. I know some individual people right now sitting in beds that can't get out. And this is an unacceptable situation.
The problem revolves around the quality of the material being used in the resurfacing. Kinnick Construction is the contractor on the job, and they've been working at getting the right mix of surface that fits the state's requirements. But there's been a lot of trial and error. Mayor Joseph Klaika has written to the governor about the community's concerns. In his letter, Klaika states that people are worried that the construction is taking too long and flights will be even worse this winter. More foul weather and dark days will make flights even more difficult to get in and out of Bethel. Morgan Merritt with the State Department of Transportation says a plan is in place to get the project complete, at least temporarily. He gave Bethel City Council an update during their last meeting. In a back-and-forth conversation with the mayor, Merritt said the plan includes refilling the side of the runway that has been excavated.
And the goal is to basically put a Band-Aid on that and remark it and get a test flight with FAA in probably 20 to 30 days. So we're estimating it's going to be 20 to 30 days before the instrument approach is reopened by the FAA.
I think the huge concern for Bethel is it just has to be done before winter. It has to be
It's understood
completed before
that there's
winter.
A very high priority, and there will be there is a financial penalty being applied to the contractor right now, and it will, if they don't fix it, it will apply to them all through the winter, and they are doing their best to get that reopened.
Merritt says they don't know yet whether the material that's going down now will be temporary or permanent, but it will have to withstand grooving.
Particularly during the winter time under icy conditions and wet conditions of the fall. So they can't just put down peanut butter. It's got to be pretty good.
The project deadline is the end of September. If Kinnick doesn't make that deadline, the state will enforce more penalties against them. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The founder and leader of the Unification Church died Monday in South Korea at the age of 92. The Reverend Sun Myung Moon had a home in Kodiak, which he would visit often. Chris Fiala is the husband of the church's Kodiak pastor. He said Reverend Moon felt Kodiak was a special place.
But he also felt it was a providentially very, very special place. He had kind of his own unique insight on how important this place was for God. So we're very awed by that, and we want to respect that. But I would say myself, we don't really understand it that deeply, what he felt about Kodiak.
Moon would go to Kodiak a couple of times a year to sport fish. Even though he was recognizable worldwide and led a church and church businesses worth hundreds of millions of dollars, Fiala said Moon fit in Kodiak.
He used to walk down the streets. He walked by my house with his wife hand in hand, and he was very comfortable. His wife liked shopping in Walmart and just hanging out with the people in Kodiak. That was something they really loved to do here. So they felt very at home here. They never felt threatened here.
The Unification Church owns the International Seafoods plant in Kodiak and operates a number of fishing boats. It is also the dominant supplier of fresh seafood to a majority of sushi restaurants in America.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Falls are the leading cause of workplace fatalities in the construction industry. Your family's well-being depends on you staying healthy during the work season. Employers, for no-cost safety and health consultation and training services, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health at 1-800-656-4972. This message sponsored by the Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
Cases of West Nile virus are on the rise in the United States. This year, every state in the country, except Hawaii and Alaska, have recorded cases of the mosquito-borne illness, which is carried by birds. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, Alaska has never documented a case of the sometimes deadly disease being contracted in the state.
There's no telling exactly how many birds migrate to and from Alaska each year or how many mosquitoes breed in the state's 287,000 square miles of wetlands and swamps. Some experts wonder if there's a connection between this year's outbreak of West Nile virus in the lower 48 and climate change. But state epidemiologist Louisa Castrodale says it may take more than birds, mosquitoes, and a changing climate to spread the virus to Alaska.
It's not like we could say, you know what, if our average temperature increases 1 degree, we're going to see it. There's a lot of factors going on with the ecology and the wildlife, with the mosquitoes. I mean, it's just, I think it's hard to predict if we would ever see it. And, you know, what exactly needs to change for the birds or the mosquitoes or temperature? I think it's pretty hard to predict.
According to NPR, all birds are susceptible to the disease, but it's more likely to kill corvids, birds like ravens, jays, and crows. Robins seem to spread the virus more widely than other birds because they can breed more than once in a season. Castrodale says those are the birds Alaska's Department of Health focused on when they started looking for the virus nearly a decade ago.
There is federal funding that was available to pursue things like testing of birds, testing of mosquito, developing laboratory capacity in state for that. And so we were fortunate to receive some of that. You know, I think it was like 2003 to 2006 or so.
As the Center for Disease Control learned more about where West Nile had the greatest impact, officials redistributed available funding to monitor and manage the virus. That didn't include funding in Alaska. State and federal authorities still monitor wildlife for the disease, but Castrodale says the health department isn't worried about an outbreak this far north anytime soon.
I think at this point, with what we know and what other people are learning about the species of mosquito, the time that virus stays in birds, the type of birds that are migrating and when, I mean, it's a big, complicated picture. And so, at this point, we're not worried about it. It could be that the ecology changes and we might have more concern in the future. But at this point, it doesn't seem like it's likely in the future.
Texas has been hardest hit this summer. Of the nearly 1,600 cases in the lower 48, more than 700 were reported in the Lone Star State. More than 60 people have died from the virus this year. People who are infected can develop a lifelong immunity. The CDC estimates that 3 million Americans have been infected with the virus since it first showed up in the U.S. in 1999. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A group of students from youth to elders are learning the Tsimshian language at the new Ketchikan Indian Community Technical Training Center. KRBD's Layla Carey attended a recent class and has the story.
Ketchikan Indian Community's new technical training center has a wing dedicated to language preservation. Almost daily, fluent speakers are recorded either at the center or in their homes, with the goal of not only maintaining an audio record of the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian languages, but eventually creating a series of textbooks to teach the Southeast Native languages into the future. KIC also offers beginner classes for each of the area's native languages. The class that's happening now teaches Shimalgyach, the Tsimshian language.
We have learned a lot from trial and error over the last 30 years and all the attempts to preserve language and teach it. Originally, everybody followed the westernized academic method. We tried to teach our native languages the same way that English is taught, but it didn't work.
That's instructor Terry Burr. She says the best way of sharing a language seems to be the tried-and-true method of one-on-one sessions between mentors and students. KIC's language teachers bring that method into the classroom. For example, when a student traditionally comes to visit an elder, they must announce themselves in the native tongue before they can come inside.
So you would hear a knock, knock, knock at the door. If you're the visitor, you would announce yourself. So, or an elder might say from the other side, Nayukwa, who is here? And then you need to announce yourself on the other side of the door. I would say, Terigwa. I can't come in until they tell me, Tsin, Tsin. That's our Tsimshian way of saying come in.
Students in Burr's class go through that exercise each day, taking turns playing the role of mentor and novice. Once they've made it through the door, students practice simple conversation skills with each other, such as, how are you, and I'm fine. Burr also gives cultural context to her students, telling stories that she's heard from elders. She says part of that cultural context is a sense of fun.
In our Tsimshian culture, We're very humorous people, affectionate people, and so we have a lot of laughing. And I think that's another part of distinguishing our teaching style apart from the westernized academic method, is that when we teach, when we're handing down knowledge, there's a lot of heavy responsibilities, but you don't have to do it with a heavy heart.
Burr's students range from the very young to elders. She says the older students often are dormant speakers and recognize words as the class continues. Included in the lessons practiced during our recent class were common animal names.
Who remembers the word for seagull? And that's that deep G. Sounds like you're gargling or gurgling.
Student Mary Terry Haldane Kennedy is a Tsimshian, originally from Metlakatla. She sits quietly in class, takes careful notes, and pays close attention to the lessons. She says she often heard Shemal Gich spoken when she was a child. Now, though, it's rare.
I think I was very fortunate to hear it, and I understood it, but as time went on, our fluent speakers passed away, and so I heard it less and less. So then the next time I heard it, I'd understand less. And then because it's just, it hasn't been in our communities as much, it's harder to understand.
Kennedy says words often come back to her during class, and she appreciates the opportunity to become familiar again with her people's language.
And so I think more needs to be done to have programs so that we could carry on our language.
The classes are open to everyone, regardless of their ethnic heritage. Burr says beginners don't even have to wait for the next class session. They can come in any day and start learning Shemal Gich. For example, in a single class, this reporter picked up this great phrase. Ashkadi anogu shkat. I don't like spiders. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A recent statewide survey by Dittman Research showed that 65% of Alaskans think it's time to build the Kinnick Arm Crossing, and 77% of those surveyed believe the bridge will save Alaskans time, money, and provide our economy with needed jobs. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.